Hey, welcome to Seemingly Unrelated. If you're a new listener, just click on chapter two. I've put a chapter two in. You can start the whole episode that's about fried chicken and cursed Christmas. And you can get into all that fun stuff, all set in lovely Japan, where those things make sense. For our regular listeners, though, little up front, we want to say a couple things. First of all, Naomi, you're not in this episode. What happened?
I'm not. I'm sorry. I double booked by accident with a holiday in Blackpool. Sorry I couldn't be there. But I wanted to come say hi because it's our season finale. So it felt wrong not being in the episode.
Yeah, that's true. It is our season finale. We need a little bit of Naomi in there somewhere. Obviously, she's got the editorial control. So
I'll still be editing it. Don't you worry.
I can imagine, though, you're going to do some real genie shit where, like, you pause the episode and your face fades in and you comment on something and come back.
If only I could be bothered.
So you're right. This is our season two finale. We've done 31. This is our 31st episode, regular episode, plus an additional 13 bonus episodes. So we've done 43 episodes total.
Wow. I can't believe that. That's a bit crazy.
Is wild. So we're gonna take a little break from season two to get season three ready, and we're gonna tell you a little bit more about it. If you want to find out about season three, stick to the end of the episode where we would normally have the stinger. We're gonna give you some details, but we wanted to say thank you for listening to the show, subscribing to it. And if you are interested in more, if you're saying to yourself 30 episodes not enough, now I've got to take a break, there's still patreon.com/seemingly unrelated, where there are, as I just said, 13 bonus episodes, 14th one coming out in December. The bonus episodes don't stop, no matter what. So those are going to keep coming out once a month. That can then keep you held over until then. So again, thank you. Two wild, crazy seasons, 31 bizarre experiences. And we'll see you on the other side of the episode for a little taste of what's going on in season three.
Yeah, stay around till the outro music, because it'll be after then that you'll hear us talking about. And we've got some exciting announcements, so please stay.
Super exciting.
Enjoy the episode.
The show. All right, everyone, it is, as you probably heard in the cold open, the season finale of season two of Seemingly Unrelated, the show where we go through these little everyday things, the common touchstones that we're all familiar with. We dive into their stories, we follow the threads, we learn something about the world around us that's actually pretty big. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Johnstone from the University of Glasgow, and I'm not at the moment. You probably saw her in the cold open, but you can't see her now. Naomi has disappeared. She has a bunch of chimneys she actually has to go down over the next 24 hours. That's right, folks. Naomi has been Santa Claus all along. That's the real secret of Seemingly Unrelated, is that we've had Santa Claus as our producer this entire time. But you know what? It's okay, because I'm joined by a returning guest. From what is, you don't know this, actually. This is news to you. What is our most popular episode of all time?
Come on.
The Fables and Steel episode. It is, of course, puppet maker, actor, director, researcher,
and
lecturer. It's Alicia Brett Al. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me. I've been telling everyone about our episode, so I hope that has added to the viewer count.
You're like Johnny Appleseed. You're just throwing out the podcast. So it's a season finale, but it's also December. We like holiday specials. I grew up with holiday specials. Al, you have a favorite like television holiday special you grew up with as a kid?
Holiday special. It's gotta be Generation Game, hasn't it?
What is Generation Game?
It's a classic British Saturday night TV show with the conveyor belt and the toys. and you is this ringing any bells?
This is not. I mean, gosh, now I Naomi, no,
Naomi, where are you? Generation Game, beautiful classic, fun. I don't think it's very Christmassy. It's just like me remembering a festive time in front of the TV.
So that's good because, as I just learned, a new Christmas tradition from a country I did not grow up in. Al, what do you know about Christmas in Japan?
What do I know about Christmas in Japan? It's a dating thing. Mm-hmm. It's a couple thing.
Absolutely. Number one.
Yeah.
This is a great point to hit on. Christmas in Japan is like Valentine's Day. It is, everyone goes out for the big dinners. Everyone is, their weddings. It's when weddings are super common.
Really?
And it is the busiest day of the year at
KFC. Love oh, love no, hotels.
Love hotels. Yeah, it's like there are queues outside of love hotels. Oh,
wow. Okay.
Could you explain to the audience members who don't know what a love hotel is, what a love hotel is?
It's just a wonderful hotel with wonderfully extravagantly themed rooms and nothing untoward or seedy going on at all, Andrew. It's all very innocent. Mm-hmm. I'm lying.
You're just in a room with a bunch of tanuki and their balls are not suggestive at all. They're pay-by-the-hour hotels, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know. You do not book a night. You book an hour or a block of hours at a love hotel, and explicitly for the purposes of having sex. That's the goal. It's actually supposed to be connected to sex work, but that has become less favored in Japanese society, that it's become more of a like, couples at Christmas go to the love hotel. Just imagine you're born 9 months later and as an adult you're crunching the numbers and you go, oh man, did my dad take my mom to a love hotel on Christmas Eve? Ooh. What's really interesting, of course, is that the trappings that we know of Christmas, like garlands and wreaths and trees and Santa Claus and all these sorts of things, are totally on display, right? They're totally available in Japan. But one of the big differences, and this is like a very Japanese way of doing things, is they're on display in public spaces. Mm. Nobody has a Christmas tree at home in Japan. That would be weird. That would be kind of, unless you're Christian, which something like 2 or 3% of Japan's population Christian. But otherwise, no. You don't have that stuff at home. Japan has a purposefully enforced way of distinguishing that which is Japanese from that which is foreign, right? So Christmas comes to Japan and we say, we like it, but we're not bringing it into the home. Mm. We're not making it Japanese. It's going to be out in the public spaces, but it's not just people boning on Christmas. There's also delicious food, and the number one food in Japan on Christmas is actually Christmas cakes.
Yes! Yeah. I saw them in the supermarkets when I was there, and I had the brochure. Oh my god, they look so good. But you had to pre-order them like months and months. Yes. It was like October when I was there or something, and everyone was already looking at this catalog.
It is worse than a pub in Britain when the sign, you know, it's bad news. The earlier that sign comes out that says book your Christmas, you're like, oh, you're having a tough year. You guys, it is October. No one's coming to your pub for Christmas. Sorry. No, you got to order that cake in advance ever since the early, well, technically since like the 1920s, but escalating since the 1950s. Mm. A strawberry shortcake has been, or a chocolate strawberry cake has been the Christmas food of Japan, bar none. Something stupid like 40 million of them get sold every year. But the other food, of course, you already mentioned it, Al. It's Kentucky Fried Chicken. Kentucky Fried Chicken. Have you, when you saw the Christmas cakes, did you also see people putting an order in for Kentucky Fried Chicken?
I saw the poster in the window because they have the street, the statue, the full 100% scale statue of that Christmas icon that we all know, the candle.
Absolutely. And that's our first seemingly unrelated, right? Is the idea that in Japan, oh, well, first one was that people bone on Christmas. Yeah. famously, no one boned on Christmas. That's the point.
That's
she
the
was
point.
A virgin, Mary. But in Japan, it's a different story. But our big seeming unrelated, the first part is Kentucky Fried Chicken is considered Christmas dinner for something like 20 million homes or 17 million homes, depending on the source you ask, in Japan. Roughly 40% of Japan's population eats Kentucky Fried Chicken on Christmas, which combined with the Love Hotel thing, that's real messy. Outside of every Kentucky Fried Chicken is a two-scale.
Yeah.
Plastic, usually sometimes stone, statue of Colonel Harlan Sanders, the founder of Kentucky Fried Chicken, and he at Christmas time they put a little Santa suit. It is a strange story, right? Because it makes, like you said, one, the fuck does Colonel Sanders have to do with Christmas? And two, Kentucky Fried Chicken is really stupidly popular in Japan. It is the number one non-native, non-Japanese fast food restaurant in Japan. Mm. Mos Burger beats it out, barely, but that's from Japan, of course. Beating out McDonald's, oddly enough, which is weird. I would have thought McDonald's would settle in. There is an asterisk to put on that because technically Starbucks, I think, is doing better business now. But I don't know. Starbucks KFC doesn't feel like a one-to-one comparison to me. Personally.
Different. No chicken at Starbucks.
Unless it's a sad wrap.
Have a sad wrap. There you go. Yeah, the drinks at Starbucks Japan are incredible. And there are blogs that I read just to hear about the drinks coming out. Sakura flavored drinks. Each season has its own flavor and its own color. Yep. I just like to read. I don't like to give Starbucks my money. I just like to see the pics.
I agree with that choice because they go whole hog on this. It's like what if the Shamrock Shake from McDonald's, but like every couple weeks there's a new one at Starbucks. That's the Japanese Starbucks way. So how did this happen? Why is KFC so dominant in Japan? What does it have to do with Christmas? You have to wind the clock back, right? So back in the 1960s. Colonel Sanders sold off KFC to a bunch of investors, and those investors sort of believed that the US marketplace for KFC was saturated, right? And so they needed to expand outside of their domestic market, right? So by about 1969, they had said, I don't think we can go anywhere else in the US. Right. At the same time, the Mitsubishi Corporation, who you probably know as a manufacturer of cars.
Not chicken.
See, Mitsubishi used to be a Zaibatsu, which is like a family run monopoly kind of a situation. Yeah. And then after the war, as things sort of shook out, they had to split into a couple of different companies. And one of them basically is Mitsubishi Motors, which is the thing you know as Mitsubishi, which is the traditional, that's how they got started. And then one of them was just sort of like Mitsubishi Incorporated. And Mitsubishi Incorporated was like, well, what are we going to do? And so they tried to invest in a couple of different things to become a profitable business. And the big thing they invested in was chicken. They invested heavily in chicken farms and chicken factories, like processing plants. And the third thing, and this is where they realized they kind of made a mistake, chicken cooking equipment, right? So they thought initially that their business would primarily be eggs. But it turns out that, like, despite the popularity of tamagoyaki or anything like that, like eggs, for folks who don't know eggs, you eat a fair amount of eggs in Japanese cuisine. It's pretty normal. The demand was met. Everyone had all the eggs.
we got enough jammy yolk middle eggs. We're good.
Yeah. Because, like, yeah, it's Japan. I also got to imagine, like, feeding chickens off of, with the mountainous terrain of Japan. Maybe chickens eat rice? Do chickens eat rice?
Enough of something completely unrelated.
Would they explode like pigeons if you...
Would they explode like pigeons?
You can't feed a pigeon rice.
I don't know that pigeons do explode if they eat rice.
Why do I know that? Is that a British thing? Is that another British thing that we're told?
I've heard it. Oh you I have it. Also heard it. Yeah, at weddings we used to throw rice and then someone started saying, oh, don't do that because the pigeons will explode. Why do they explode? I've got questions. So the Mitsubishi Corporation, it's got a lot of chickens. It's got a lot of chicken broilers. And now they are thinking, okay, let's figure out a retail option where we can sell the chicken broilers to the shop and then sell the chickens to that shop. And they'll produce a food product for the end consumer. So the stars aligned.
Smooth business plan.
Yeah, because Mitsubishi went and looked at the EU, well, it wasn't called the EU yet, but European countries, the EEC, North America, Latin America, and they went to find out what's the company that buys the most chicken broilers, which turned out to be Kentucky Fried Chicken. So that was it. They contact KFC. KFC sends this guy named, like, Len Wesley, I think was his name. They send him over to Japan and they start cooking up a partnership. So for the first several years, not anymore, but for the first several years, all Kentucky Fried Chickens in Japan were technically owned by Mitsubishi. They were licensing out the KFC brand and design and these sort of things to make that happen. So this is really interesting. And by the way, kind of began the world as we know it in a lot of ways, because KFC is in 118 countries. This ends up being so successful. I mean, we've already talked about how Christmas is KFC, so I'm not spoiling anything. This ends up being so successful that they then do it again in places like Vietnam eventually, but in Taiwan, in Australia, in the Philippines, and then they head over to European countries that come to the UK and I think 77, if I recall correctly. And they start going out there and they do so well that then McDonald's goes, we should do the same. And then Burger King says, we should do the same. And then Starbucks 30 years later, we should do the same. So on and so forth.
Wow.
And that's why whenever you go to any city, anywhere in the goddamn world, you will see a United States born and bred fast food restaurant very quickly.
Yeah.
7-Eleven followed KFC into Japan.
Wait, what? 7-Eleven isn't Japanese?
Enough of something completely unrelated.
That's from the United States.
No, but it's just my favorite Asian thing. Every time I go to Asia, I'm just like, I can't wait to go to 7-Eleven.
Do not feel the same way. You will not feel the same way about 7-Eleven in the United States. I assure you. No, 7-Eleven, it started off as one, but it was a chain of convenience stores that were open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. And when they did that, that was like unheard of. Yeah. That was just like a thing that nobody did. And they would also be open on Sundays, which was like, ooh, open on Sunday. Jesus will cast you. But it worked super well. And then they expanded from there. And when KFC succeeds, they also follow KFC in the early 80s, I think, is when they finally pop up in Japan. So yeah, KFC is the first ever U.S. retail company to open a shop in Japan that succeeded. Other companies had tried to open retail, especially in the pre-war period. There were a few attempts, but none of them really took off. And then after the war, of course, U.S. companies were a little hesitant sometimes to do that. Because of the whole occupation and the war and all these kinds of things. Took a little while to get over that, but not for KFC. So, the very first KFC anywhere in Japan, you want to take a guess? What? I'll narrow it down to the island. It is on the island of Honshu.
Okay.
Where did they try to build first?
In Tokyo. No?
No. Nagoya.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they thought, because the KFC model is built on the suburbs in the United States. So for folks who don't know, Nagoya is kind of like halfway between Osaka and Tokyo. Tokyo and Osaka are the two biggest cities in Japan. They together, I think, represent something silly, like a third of all of Japan's total population, maybe more than that, just in those two cities alone. And so Nagoya is kind of smack dab in the middle. So it's just very sort of suburban. And so they just built a standalone restaurant and it failed miserably. Failed miserably. It was doing absolutely no business because people didn't know what it was. The manager, who was a 27-year-old printer, who found out about KFC because his company got the contract to make the buckets, to print the buckets, and he jumped ship from his day job and was like, I think this is really going to fly. Takeshi Okawara, he manages this KFC, and he says that people kept thinking it was a barber shop.
No!
Yeah, he's got the stripes, the red and white. Yeah, so they'd be like, do I get a haircut here? You're frying chicken. That's weird. Does the chicken cut my hair? How does this shake out? So he was just desperate trying to figure out, oh my God, how do I sell chicken? And so he was sleeping in the store. He was sleeping on sacks of flour as his bed. It's a hell of a story. I mean, this is what he says. How much of it is true? Blah, blah, blah. Who cares?
Beautiful story.
It's just a good story. And so a nearby Christian-run school asked if he could wear a Santa suit and come over and do some, like, singing and dancing because he needed some money. They were going to give him, you know, here's whatever, it's 1970s, here's 5,000 yen, please come over and, like, entertain the children. He needs money, he'll do it. But he decided to bring a barrel, an entire barrel of chicken with him, and just hand it out, with the idea being, you know, the first one's free, the kids will, like, maybe tell their parents, and then someone will come to my goddamn chicken shop.
It's a Christmas miracle.
It was a Christmas miracle, right? Because everyone absolutely loved it.
Yeah!
Because it's undeniable. One, Kentucky Fried Chicken is fucking delicious.
It's so good.
It's so good.
Nothing will stop the child from dragging their parent all the way.
Mm-hmm. The teachers thought it was great. The kids loved it. The kids tell their parents. Other schools that aren't Christian affiliated in the neighborhood in around Nagoya, they start inviting him to do the same. And like from the ashes of failure, like a phoenix rises this guy, Takeshi Okawara. And he kind of gets promoted to the chief operating officer of KFC in Japan. Because they're like, all right, clearly you knew what to do. And this is the guy who says, all right, here's the problem. Mm. This drive-through nonsense doesn't make any sense. This is Japan. This is fast food. Japan has a history of fast food. Mm. That's what sushi is. Mm.
Yeah. Right?
That's what ramen is. Mm. And where do you get ramen and sushi most often in Japan if you want to get it fast? Now.
Where do you get it if you want to get it fast? You get it from the konbini, and you put hot water in it.
But that's true. Okay, to be fair to you, that is what you would do now. But traditionally, like a little, like a soba or an udon shop is just a bar with like some flags hanging down, and you just plunk down and you eat it real fast and you slurp it up. Sorry to all the people who have misophonia. But he was thinking they're all next to train stations.
Yes. The best restaurants in Japan are in the train stations. That's the hack.
You want those high foot traffic, people going to pop in, pop out. That his initial plan of not plan, his accidental discovery that connecting it to Christmas meant that people would think this was like an American thing. Like, oh yeah, Americans love Kentucky Fried Chicken at Christmas. Yeah. And so so NHK interviewed him because this meteoric rise, and they said, hey, is this like normal in the United States? And he said, yes. He lied bald face on television and said, Kurisumasu niwa Kentucky is for sure a thing in America.
Genius, man. Genius. Manifest it.
Absolutely brilliant, right? What's even better is, Lou Weston, by the way, I think I said Len earlier, but Lou Weston was the name of the American guy who had come over. He is the dude who had a statue of the colonel that was like on display at a like convention when KFC was looking to expand into Canada. It was just a thing they had outside and it didn't work. Like they didn't make it into Canada on the first try. Canada wasn't that interested. So Lou took that statue just because he thought it looked creepy and he brought it back with him. And Takeshi goes, and on top of it, to make the place stand out, and make it, quote, authentically American, we should make more of these statues, and we should put a statue in front of every one of those KFCs. That is how KFC gets settled in to the United States. That's when the Christmas connection is made. But by 1980, it's doing about $200 million in business. Campaign around Nagoya and Osaka, which is where the next couple branches open in Osaka. But the transformation into a national treasure starts in 1986. 1986 is when KFC goes from regional success to national hit and becomes the Christmas story. Mm. And this is our next seemingly unrelated. Al, what is your favorite Nippon League baseball team?
I'm trying to think of the one that's in Yokohama because I went to the stadium on the way to the theater. Does it have a logo? It's blue colored.
That's true. That's true. I know it's blue colored.
The Yokohama blue birds.
Amazing. I believe it's the Bay Stars.
The
blue ones.
The blue
ones. The Yokohama Bay Stars are indeed a part of the Japanese Nippon League, which for people not familiar, is just what we call the major leagues of baseball in Japan. It's the major leagues in the United States. It's the Nippon League in Japan. And that's it. We're talking about billion-dollar teams in the US and Japan, and we're talking about like $1 million teams in every other country. It's a big difference. So yeah, there's like about a dozen major teams, give or take, depending on the years, that play in the Nippon League. And just like in every sporting league in the world, there are the ones that seem to win all the time, which is in Nippon League, the Yomiuri Giants in Tokyo. It's my team. I like the Giants. And there are perennial losers. The perennial losers of the Nippon League are the Hanshin Tigers of Osaka. Aww. Yeah, they
Sorry, guys.
It's okay, because in 1985, Al, they were kicking ass. They were kicking ass taking names. In 1985, the Hanshin Tigers in May, late May, they pulled ahead of the Giants in the standings. And that's the first time they had done that since the Second World War. They had never been ahead of the Giants. And suddenly they were, and they never let go. They became the winningest team in all of Japan, and actually hold like one of the, I think it's the top 10, one of the top 10 best records in a season ever in Japanese baseball history. And on the 16th of October in 1985, the Hanshin Tigers won the Central League Championship, which ended the regular season and meant that they were going to head to the Japan Series and playoffs for the finale, what we would call the World Series in the United States, but it's the Japan Series in Japan. One of the main reasons for this is that they had recruited in 1985 a new first baseman, future Oklahoma State Senator Randy Bass, joined the Hanshin Tigers.
What a name.
Yes, Randy Basu. Randy Basu became the first baseman for the Hanshin Tigers in 1985 season. For a lot of reasons, he wasn't doing very well in the MLB in the United States. It's 1986. Japan has a stupid, or 1985, excuse me, has a stupid amount of money. So they, let's get an American baseball player. But like, Randy Bass is a really good baseball player. Like, he still has the record today, last I checked, for the highest batting average in Japanese baseball history. So he's kicking ass and taking names. Every time he goes up to the plate, he gets on base. The offense for the Tigers is outstanding. So the Tigers win the Central League Championship. So what do they do, Al? When sports teams win, what do sports fans do?
Sports fans drink beer and go to little restaurants and celebrate.
This is true. These are all things that sports fans do. They do other things as well. I'm going to do a little quote, read a little quote out here from an eyewitness account of what happened that evening, October 16th, 1985, in Osaka, which is where the Hanshin Tigers live. The instant the Tigers won, Kobe and Osaka devolved into riots. Trains were hijacked in celebration. Osaka's downtown district of Namba was filled with people. It took me 2 hours to walk home from the bar, and news reports continued long into the night. In a frenzy, fans began to dive into the river from the Dotonbori Ridge, each screaming the name of the Tigers player that they most resembled. After a few minutes, a concerned fan realized that no one was yelling Randy Basu, because, of course, none of the fans were white. Hoping to give his favorite player the honor he deserved, the concerned fan stole a statue of Colonel Sanders from outside of the Namba Kentucky Fried Chicken and threw it in the river, with everyone in the crowd yelling, Randy Basu! As the statue crashed through the surface.
I was almost going to say that. I was almost going to say that.
Yes. Sports Fans love a riot. That is universal everywhere you go. Win or lose, sports fans will riot. It is just what's going to happen. So yeah, the Hanshin Tigers fans went nuts. They're rioting. They're jumping in the river. They're hijacking trains.
Wow. It's even chaos. In Japan, the most well-behaved people.
You say that, but I was in Tokyo for Halloween, and motherfuckers were just setting stuff on fire.
No way.
It was nuts. And the news the next day was like, foreigners set things on fire in Japan. You're like, yeah, foreigners. This happens every year, and yet it's the foreigners who are setting things on fire. Sure thing, Japanese media.
Sure.
So, yeah, the Tigers go on to win the Japan series, they win the championship game a couple weeks later, and everyone kind of forgets about it. The problem is, from 1986 until 2023, 37 years, the Hanshin Tigers lost every single season. They would be in the bottom three, with one exception being in like 2003. So they become not just losers. They become like the peak losers following this season. And Hanshin Tigers fans were convinced that it's because of Colonel Sanders. They believed that by disrespecting Colonel Sanders and throwing his statue into the river where no one could find it. By the way, it went. No one recovered it until 2009. No, it was recovered in 2009. Missing one hand and his glasses.
No!
So they thought, oh, the spirit of Colonel Sanders is angry, and our team will never win again until the statue is recovered. Mm. Which they did in 2023. They did win again, but it was a full like 15 years after the statue was recovered. So the thing about sports fans is they're really superstitious. So from this, it begins to spread everywhere, because now KFC starts moving into around baseball stadiums and into, like, as it spreads across the country, people who are baseball fans start going to KFC around baseball games because they are like, we don't want the curse of the Colonel. We don't want to disrespect the curse of the Colonel. And it just so happens that the baseball season ends just as the Christmas season picks up. So at the end of the season, when people are spending the most at KFC to ensure their team wins the championship, the Colonel is dressed up like Santa Claus outside. And so that pre-ordering of the Christmas dinner is across much of Japan is actually the direct result of the Hanshin Tigers and the curse of the Colonel kicking things off.
Yeah.
A truly insane story. And so that is the story of Japanese Christmas, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and the Hanshin Tigers. How culture doesn't always translate across borders, right? If you want to be a success in a foreign country, you've got to find a way to attach yourself to those cultural landmarks, sports, religion, family. If you can find a way to become mingled up in that, you will never fail. And indeed, KFC has pretty much, even during the like 90s when the whole economy collapsed, KFC expanded. Like, it has never really shrunk in Japan. And really, honestly, isn't that what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown? A bunch of stories from a Middle Eastern country, like blending in perfectly with a bunch of European pagan solstice festivals. And then we set something on fire every year.
Yeah.
Calling it a Yule log. Al, what did you learn this time from our wonderful tour around Christmas in Japan?
I learned that my precious 7-Eleven is not as Asian as I thought it was. But it's still perfect, and the Japan flavor is exquisite. The Taiwanese flavor is exquisite. I look forward to trying the other versions, but I'm shocked.
Yeah. So that's our Christmas tour. That's our second season. We've been doing this now for a little over a year, and we managed to fit two whole seasons in. You'll hear all about what season three is going to be like. But before you jump off to learn about that, Al, where can people find you if they want to engage with more Alicia Britt content out there? Where should they head off to?
Yes. So I'm on Instagram at Anna_Mater, Anna Mater, Anna_Mator. Or my website, Alicia Britt. Watch this space for more exciting business.
Absolutely. We will link off to things where you can see Al. From our bucket of fried chicken to your love hotel at home, this has been season two of Seemingly Unrelated. Happy holidays wherever you celebrate them. Wherever you celebrate them. There's one more bonus episode left for those of you who pay for it, but otherwise, this is it. We will see you in the new year for season three. Bye bye, everybody.
Bye. Merry chicken.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone, audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Coe. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seemingly_unrelatedpod.com. Welcome to the stinger-ish, I guess. As we said at the beginning, we just want to give you a little taste, a little morsel.
Oh, I hate that sound.
Cut that sound out, Naomi, immediately.
Really disgusting.
Gross. That's what season three is about, being gross. No, season three is not. We want to do things a little bit different. I have always felt like the more voices we could bring into the show, the better. You've seen that shift happen, all of our guest hosts. And so I want to make sure we're doing that. Naomi, you've got some ambitions. I don't know if you've been thinking, want to tell people what you've been thinking about wanting to do.
I just love podcasts. And I feel like we've done two seasons of really solid work, but I'm ready to like try something new. So I'm thinking we're doing some more experimental audio, doing a bit more soundscaping in the episodes, just being a bit more creative with it and not doing separate episodes where they're about a different topic, but one series where we follow the thread throughout. So that's the plan.
Yes. Season three, we're going to do, instead of every other week for half of the year, we're going to do a 8-episode limited series that is going to be one seemingly unrelated story divided into 8 tinier seemingly unrelated stories. Will still be fun. Like, it'll still be our voice and authentic to what we do, but it'll be something that's a little more of a deep dive into a particular subject that looks at it from a bunch of different viewpoints. And we'll be bringing in some expert voices that get cut in maybe. And we're hoping to have sort of a regular co-host for me to work with, or actually both of us to work with, and something that will be a little more produced, a little less off the cuff than what we've done in the past. And we really just both believe in podcasting as like a creative medium. There's no rules that say we have to like keep
doing the exact same thing. We're throwing out the rule book. Because I think we've got our structure now. We know how to do this one thing. So let's switch it up and see what else we can do. And that doesn't mean we can't come back to the original structure. Or if everyone prefers it, then maybe that's what we do. But I think we've got into a pattern of releasing every 2 weeks now. And so the one thing is that we're going to need a bit of a break to restructure it and rethink about it and maybe make all of the episodes in one go and then release them weekly. So it's probably going to be not until about the beginning of March.
Yes.
That we do this.
We're aiming for an early March, maybe even the first week of March release of season three. So that'll be all of January and February. You'll still have bonus episodes in the paid feed and patreon.com/seemingly unrelated. And we're really looking forward to just getting to do something fun, something new, and something that's, I think, going to be an exciting take on the seemingly unrelated concept. So.
And if you hate it, then we'll just go back to what we normally do.
Then we'll just go back to what we normally do.
And we'll
do.
Pretend we never did it.
Absolutely. We can poop these things out in 2 weeks. It's easy.
Yeah.
Run into season four immediately, or we'll just call it season three, but for real this time. So stay subscribed to the show. You know, there's the newsletter you can check in on. There's the Patreon you can check in on. We're still going to be on Instagram, TikTok. All those places, go check those out, and we'll see you guys in March for season three of Seemingly Unrelated.
And let us know what you think in the comments. We want to hear
Please
from
do.
You.
Yeah, yes. You got any suggestions? Do you want to hate us and rage quit the entire show? Make sure you leave a comment first. We want that feedback. All right, gang. We'll see you all in March.
See you
Have
March.
A wonderful new year.
Have a lovely holiday season.
Bye.
Bye.